Now, WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming pianist-composer Jonathan Fayman for an afternoon of chamber music on March 14th, the San Francisco Symphony with violinist Gil Shaham as soloist on March 17th, and violinist Joshua Bell in a solo recital on April 1st. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. AM 580 thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the show, we are supposed to be in contact with Dennis Kucinich, presidential candidate on the Democratic side in the primary. He remains on the campaign trail, and in fact, he'll be in Champaign-Urbana this evening at 8 o'clock at the Illini Union, 8 to 10. There's an event going on there. A couple other events he's attending as well in Champaign-Urbana, and we're trying to make contact with him by telephone. And so far, we're not having much luck, although we hope that luck will turn momentarily. It's been my experience that in the heat of a campaign, the candidates are essentially in a state of chaos, and they're doing many, many things. There are many demands on them, and whenever something is on the schedule, you got to put a question mark by it. But we hope that we can answer that question definitively this morning and actually have a chance to talk with Dennis Kucinich. It looks like we're actually getting through. Let me just mention a couple of things about Dennis Kucinich. In 1977, he was elected mayor of Cleveland at the age of 31, the youngest mayor of any major U.S. city. He later served in the Ohio State Senate and was elected to Congress in 1996. He is chairman of the Progressive Caucus, the largest caucus of Democrats in Congress. He was an early critic of nuclear power and in Congress has championed many environmental causes. He has called for the establishment of a Department of Peace to make nonviolence an organizing principle of American society. And he also has called for nuclear disarmament, preservation of the ABM Treaty, and banning weapons in space. He continues to draw the interest of many voters for his outspoken criticism of the occupation of Iraq. He has spoken against NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and against the Patriot Act. He also favors a single-payer universal health care plan, increased protections for workers, and a clean energy policy. These are a few of the issues Dennis Kucinich has raised as a contestant in the Democratic presidential primary, and we'll have a chance to hear more about these and other issues as we talk with him during this hour. As we do speak with Dennis Kucinich, you are welcome to join the conversation. That's what this program is all about. We believe that dialogue on important public policy issues is essential in a democracy and especially in an election. So we invite you to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere outside of Champaign-Urbana, if you're listening around the Midwest or actually on the internet, anywhere in the continental U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And Dennis Kucinich joins us this morning by telephone. Congressman Kucinich, good morning.
Thank you, and good morning. It's good to be with you.
Well, we're very glad to have you with us. And again, I want to mention that you are appearing tonight in Champaign-Urbana, 8 o'clock at the Illini Union.
I'll be at the Illini Union in the Illini Room, and that's at 8 o'clock. I look forward to seeing everyone there.
Okay, very good. Well, sorry to ask a question like this to start, but it looks like John Kerry has a lock on the nomination, but you haven't stopped campaigning. What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, you know, the direction of the nomination may be a decided matter, but the direction of the Democratic Party is not. I mean, we're still in war in Iraq, and the Democrats need to take a strong position that causes us to bring U.N. peacekeepers in and bring our troops home. We need to make sure that the Democrats stand for peace, that the Democrats stand for health care for all, that the Democrats stand for fair trade. And, you know, my presence in this race assures the Democrats have an active voice and an active campaign to challenge the prevailing assumptions which are guiding some of our policymakers in the party.
Mm-hmm. And do you see John Kerry carrying those issues forward? I mean, what do you hope to contribute to what is eventually going to be the campaign of the nominee?
You know, it's one thing to win the nomination. It's another thing to win the election. And I don't believe the American people are ready to trade, for example, a Republican version of the war in Iraq or a Democratic version of the same. And so it's my campaign, which is keeping alive these issues and enabling the debate to continue inside the Democratic Party while the nomination may, at this point, be a foregone conclusion. There needs to be a debate about the direction America is going to go in. If we think that by limiting debate somehow we're serving the American public, I don't think that's correct.
Okay. Well, I certainly want to talk about some of the key issues that you have raised and give you a chance to speak on those issues. I also want to include callers, and we have a couple people waiting.
Great. So, well, we can go right to callers if you want to. It'd be
okay.
Fine.
Well, I want to defer to them since that's what the show is about. We'll go first to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, Dennis Kucinich. I love you.
Hi.
I have two questions.
Yes.
Your plan to get the UN in and the U.S. out is great, but how would you get the war profiteers out? That's my first question.
Well, that's part of the plan, and here's how the war profiteers get out. First of all, everyone knows why we're in Iraq. It's because of oil. And we need to go to the UN and ask the UN to handle those oil assets of Iraq on behalf of the Iraqi people until the Iraqi people are self-governing, to hold them in trusteeship, so that the oil assets are not going to be stripped by those who are aligned with the United States for the purpose of grabbing the oil. The same thing is true with the contracts. Now, Halliburton has been engaged in profiteering there, and we need to understand that all of those contracts present the opportunity to make a profit at the expense of the American taxpayer and the Iraqi people. And so we need to turn over the contract process to the UN to handle that on behalf of the Iraqi people until the Iraqi people can handle their own affairs. So there isn't going to be any more Halliburton sweetheart deals, and so we can make sure the Iraqi people get jobs. And finally, with respect to war profiteering, you know, what more glaring example is there of war profiteering than the administration's plans to privatize the government functions of the economic functions in Iraq? This administration, on September 19th, the year 2003, set forth a plan to privatize the top 200 economic activities in the Iraq economy, to turn them over to private interests. I mean, that is a form of theft. It's a violation of both the Geneva and the Hague Conventions. It's something that I've been challenging, and frankly, we cannot even hope to have peace in the Middle in that region until we renounce the efforts at privatization and stop that other kind of profiteering, which privatization would be a party to.
I have a second question. That was a great answer. Why has the commercial media essentially blackballed you?
Well, you know what? I think there's plenty of time to get back in this debate, and I'm glad to be on this show. I haven't. It hasn't discouraged me in any way that some of the national networks want to move on and just make this a, about the November election. What remains to be seen is what the Democrats stand for. And I'm in this race to give this party some backbone and to enable the party to really take a strong stand on issues that relate to peace, health care, and trade.
Thank you. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. I wanted to follow up on the issue of privatization of government functions. This is a battle you fought in Cleveland.
Right.
And actually sort of, you know, got you started on your political career. And, you know, I think that there is a sort of ideological debate about, you know, what the function of government is and what the you know, where private enterprise fits into that. And maybe it's not a debate that we're having really out loud, but sort of exists under the surface of a lot of the things that are going on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and you're correct that as mayor of Cleveland 27 years ago, I began a debate in Cleveland to save a municipal electric system from a takeover by a private utility monopoly, and we were successful in saving our municipally owned electric system. And as a result of that effort in Cleveland, I became involved in what really is a national, even international, debate over privatization. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what's the legitimate role of government in society? I mean, it's articulated in the preamble to the Constitution. But we really have to ask ourselves, does government have a role to play with the tax dollars government takes in providing for education, for health care, for retirement security, for job creation? Or is this all about the private sector and government basically is just, you know, simply a service agency for private sector interests? I happen to believe that there are certain rights in a democratic society which the government has to support. The right to an education. That's why we have public schools. If you don't have public schools and you have only private schools, then people are not going to get education because they don't have money. If you have health care and you have only private health care, well, increasingly people are finding that a private health care system is excluding their access to health care, with 43 million Americans without any health insurance. It's a glaring example of that. On the issue of Social Security, I mean, there was a time when seniors didn't have any retirement security at all. The Social Security Act enabled an opportunity to lift generations of the elderly out of poverty. And yet there are those who want to privatize Social Security and turn it over to Wall Street. I say that the retirement security is a legitimate purpose of the government, and that the providing for Social Security is fundamental, and that there ought not be privatization of Social Security. So, you know, this debate continues. And I think there's a reason to have a public sector, and that the interests of the public sector and the private sector are often mutually exclusive. The public sector existing to provide service, and the private sector existing to make a profit.
Our lines are all full. Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number two. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I want to thank Focus 580 for having you on the show, because although I know you're going to be in many places at the U of I campus, I just can't get to them easily, so this is wonderful. Thank you for calling. I want to also thank you for pushing the Democratic Party to sound more like the Democratic Party instead of just an also Republican Party. And I think you and Dean and Reverend Sharpton really, really pushed the candidates to sound like Democrats. So my thought next is, we get to the convention, we get to the platform, and I presume you want to make your position part of the platform. And my question is, do the candidates have to support the platform?
No, I mean, you know, the platform is, in some cases, it's substantive, in some cases it's ceremonial, but a platform can be the basis for winning the election if it responds to people's practical aspirations for jobs and health care and peace. And so we certainly need to influence the debate. That's why tomorrow in Illinois, I mean, people in voting for my candidacy now are free to express a direction the Democratic Party ought to take. The nomination's already been decided, but the direction of the party is not. So, you know, the platform of the party is important, but we need to start putting those planks down now, and no better place to start than in Illinois.
Okay, well, thank you. It's a very exciting prospect of having the Democrats return to their roots.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next up, someone in Spring Bay on line number three. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Two things. I'd like to send a contribution. Do you have an address for that?
Well, first of all, you know, we've been very successful in raising funds to continue this effort, and the contributions to the campaign can be either emailed or sent to Kucinich.us, which is our website. And anyone wants to get involved in the campaign, Kucinich, KUCINICH.US. And our address in Cleveland is Kucinich for President, 11808 Lorain Avenue, L-O-R-A-I-N, Lorain Avenue, Cleveland, Ohio, 44111. And, you know, this is a campaign that depends on citizens who want to create change, and they've enabled it to go this far and enabled us to go through the entire primary season where other candidates have decided, well, they can't take it anymore, and they just can't, you know, bear the winning a particular primary and having the requisite votes for the nomination. The measure of commitment of this campaign is that we are going all the way to the convention with a message of peace, health care for all, and fair trade.
The other thing I wanted to ask, that's 11808 Lorain Avenue.
11808 Lorain Avenue, Cleveland, Ohio, 44111, and that's Kucinich for President.
Yeah, okay. What's your take on the whole deregulation on electric utilities? Because Cleveland was kind of like the epicenter of that, and I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Well, first of all, the right of utility franchise is vested in the public. I mean, the utilities don't have an inherent right to operate. They get that right through the state governments. and the federal government, you know, regulates interstate commerce among utilities and also standards. Utilities consistently overcharge the public. Utilities consistently frustrate the development of new energy alternatives. I mean, the reason why we're stuck with nuclear power is because the utility industry, you know, went in league with the banks, invested heavily in nuclear power. Now they have over 100 plants around this country, some of which have safety problems, continuing to operate long past the time they were licensed, long past the time of their useful license. And, you know, we need to make a transition in our utilities and in our energy resources. If we make the transition away from coal and nuclear and oil, and we move to wind, geothermal, solar, biomass, and green hydrogen, we may come upon decentralized utility applications, which then provides a shift of the wealth in the society back to consumers and away from these big companies. So the companies have a vested interest in frustrating the ability of the public to have alternative energy and to have decentralized applications, which would then enable people to save money on their utility bills. Utility deregulation has led to an increased monopolization and a decrease of public interest activities. I mean, when you consider deregulation led some utilities to cut back on maintenance, and one in particular, First Energy in Northeast Ohio, cut back on maintenance crews sharply enough that they found themselves embroiled in the middle of that big blackout that cut off electricity to 50 million people last year. You find out that deregulation of anything in a democracy is dangerous because it means the public interest generally is going to be ill-served. There is a legitimate role for government to regulate the activities of commerce in a democratic society, and that means regulating the practices of utilities. It means regulating the practices in Wall Street. Look at how much money has been lost by investors in Wall Street because there wasn't proper regulation. You know, look at how many environmental problems come up because there's not proper enforcement of air and water pollution laws. I mean, look at how many consumer product safety failures we've had because of a lack of adequate regulation. So there is a role for regulation in a democratic society.
We're talking this morning with Dennis Kucinich. He is on the Democratic ballot for president, the Illinois primary being tomorrow. He will be among the names you will see on that ballot, and we're talking about a variety of issues. Our lines are all full, so let's get on and talk with some more callers. Next up, someone in Normal on line number 4. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, I'm going to be getting up bright and early and voting for you tomorrow because, like you said before, although the nomination's a foregone conclusion, we still get to voice our opinion as to which way we would like to see the party go. And I really like a lot of your ideas, especially your ideas about the military-industrial complex. Earlier this morning on C-SPAN, a congressman referred to it as a military-industrial congressional complex now because Congress pretty much rubber stamps everything that's set before it now. The bloated budget is up to $400 and some odd billion.
21.
Yes. What would you do to get rid of this if you could, and do you think that it's too big and too late?
Well,
I'm going to hang up and listen.
It's you know, is it too big? Yes. Is it too late? No. I have a particular expertise in this area. I happen to be the ranking Democrat, the top Democrat, on an investigative subcommittee that has jurisdiction over national security and the Department of Defense. And let me tell you what we've learned over the last few years. We've learned that the Department of Defense has over $1 trillion in accounts they cannot reconcile. There's something like 1,184 different accounting systems. They can't keep track of the money, and they can't keep track of quality control with respect to whether the taxpayers are getting any kind of value at all for what they buy. And you have one generation after another weapons systems that are put on the boards in order to keep the programs going and to keep the pork flowing. You have the Pentagon now planning to, they're building new nuclear weapons, building weapons for outer space, building a so-called missile shield at the cost of $10 billion that was actually advanced based on fraud. There's massive waste. We spend $421 billion in this budget for the Pentagon, more than all of the other nations of the world combined. And so 50% of our discretionary spending is going for the Pentagon budget. And the fear that's being driven by this administration And the cost of the war in Iraq, which is now approaching $200 billion, is causing the Pentagon budget to be driven even higher. So what's happening is we're crowding out priorities of veterans benefits and education and housing and health care and job creation. All that's being swept aside as the militarization of our society quickens. And so what I'm calling for is a new approach. Do we need to defend our country? Yes. But what's going on now is absolutely obscene. It is a rout of the taxpayers and a desecration of our American dream in the name of huge military buildups. And we need to start correcting that course. The first correction, I want to see a 15% cut in the Pentagon budget. It would in no way affect our ability to defend our country. That's more than $60 billion now, about $62 billion, would yield enough funds to create a universal daycare program for all of America's children ages 3, 4, and 5, which then would result in closing the achievement gaps that are race-based and class-based for America's children, create a five-day-a-week child care program where reading skills, educational skills, social skills, and nutrition would be provided. It would give our children a great start in those early ages as they approach elementary school experience. I mean, this is where you can start to create a shift and in the process redefine the cause of our nation, because we're rapidly becoming a Spartan-type society, and we're crushing all the aspirations of people for education and health care and the needs of the people and just the survival of the American people.
We have several people waiting. We'll go on next to someone on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. It's great that Dennis is on the program, and I would encourage other folks to vote for him to benefit the platform. But I wanted you to talk real quick. One of the things I noticed was that in all the debates that were held, the way that the journalists treated you was insulting. And I know that you can't say much about it as a candidate because you just come off looking kind of bad, or, you know, like you have thin skin or something. But I was wondering if you could address sort of the coverage that your campaign has received through the media. And I realize we're on public radio right now, but sort of overall the regular cable network and network channels. And I'll hang up and listen. And good luck for the rest of the election. Take care.
Thank you very much. You know, it's a real burden for pundits to have to determine who the next president's going to be. I mean, just think about it. If you're part of the punditocracy and you just have to somehow divin and let people know this is your candidate, and you know, on the other hand, this is not your candidate. And so, you know, my campaign was not given that much of an opportunity by some of the people in the media. But you know what? It hasn't stopped me one bit. I mean, the real question any of us face in life is, what's the measure of our commitment? Are we going to ask for permission to proceed along the path of those things that we believe in the most? Or are we ready to hang in there and to move ahead, notwithstanding whether someone wants to celebrate it through the major media? You know, I'm in this, not just through the convention, but this is part of a movement for redefining who we are as a nation, to become a more peaceful nation, become a nation that focuses more on the human needs of people, and to become a nation which stands for workers' rights and human rights and environmental quality principles in our trade agreements. I mean, we really have the chance to change the world. So the fact that someone wouldn't necessarily give notice to the campaign early on, it hasn't in any way discouraged me from moving forward. As a matter of fact, you know, I don't look to permission from these media conglomerates to decide what I'm going to do in public life. I never have. That's not the way I live.
We're at our midpoint here in our conversation with Dennis Kucinich. He is one of the Democratic candidates in the Illinois primary and around the nation for president. And your questions are welcome. We have several people waiting. I do want to mention again that he'll be appearing in Champaign-Urbana this evening at the Illini Union as part of the Progressive Democrat Forum from 8 to 10 o'clock. That's at the Illini Union. So you will have a chance to attend that as well.
You know, before you go to the next call,
sure.
There's just one thing I want to say on, mm-hmm. on, you know, and as a postscript to this previous discussion. And you know, any of the listeners now, you know, we've all had challenges in our life where people would say, well, you know, you can't do this, or there's an assumption that in order to get involved in something, you have to check with certain brokerages, and, you know, to check with this interest or that interest as to whether you can move forward. You know, if you believe in something, stand up and don't look for permission from anyone else. Sometimes, you know, you may be the first one who's willing to say something, but then it's amazing how things can change when other people see the level of commitment you have. I mean, this isn't just true of me. It's true of everyone listening. All of us face circumstances in life where someone says, well, you know, we're not going along with that. No, we reject what you're saying. But if you have any measure of commitment, you hang in there, it's amazing how things can start to change.
Well, I did want to kind of ask you about that, because I have heard people say of you and of other candidates who they favored personally, well, I would vote for this other person, but I know he's got no chance. And so I'm going to, you know, vote for the person who is maybe not quite aligned with the way I think, but who I think has a better chance. And often those definitions we have in our head about who has a chance are maybe inherited from those pundits you were talking about, or from wherever.
Well, you know, this is a good time to stop the music and look at this phenomenon of don't vote for what you believe in, vote for who you think is going to win. I mean, what a depraved way of looking at civil dialogue. I mean, if you don't vote for your heart never wins, and if you vote against your interests, guess what? You lose. And so, you know, what my candidacy represents is an opportunity for people to be able to follow their hearts and to vote for an expanded vision of what a political party can stand for and what a nation ought to stand for. And so, you know, it's not just about me, it's about the dreams that anyone has. But, you know, I heard this throughout the early primaries where people would say, well, you know, if I thought you had a chance, I'd vote for you. And I'm thinking, well, okay, what do you believe in? You're going to vote for someone who you don't agree with, and then if that person wins, what do you win? You turn around, how can you complain that the person then takes you back to a war or keeps a Patriot Act or supports corporatized health care or supports NAFTA and the WTO? Where does that leave you if you're on the opposite side on all those issues? So what I'm finding is the political process and an election process is a period of growth for all of us. And so we go through these periods of, well, you know, do I go with the winner? Well, we already know who the winner is, let's say. Now that that's been established, people can go back to voting what they believe in. The thing's decided. People can vote what they believe in, and my candidacy continues to be alive for those people who want to vote their hearts.
Our lines are all full, so let's talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. Comment and 2 questions about the idea of the way the mainstream media treated you. I think they, by denying the general public an opportunity to hear your ideas, they've done us a great injustice. And you didn't mention that, but I want to. 2 questions. I wanted to tell my wife about a story I heard on UTEL on C-SPAN in response to in an interview, but I can't remember the details. And I believe it was that, but I was just mesmerized. And it was about you working, I think it was 3 jobs at one point.
Well, I went to school. When I started school, I was working 2 jobs and going to school full time. It was something I wouldn't recommend to anyone. It's like not just burning the candle at both ends, but cutting the candle in half and burning both the halves at both ends. And it was a, and I'm sure there are other people out there who have done something that have been, that's been equally as challenging. And, you know, when I was starting school, I, like a lot of people, I had to work a couple years to save up money. And so I had 2 full-time jobs, one in the morning at a hospital as an orderly, then a surgical technician, and then another one in the afternoon as a copy boy at a newspaper in Cleveland. And so I did that for a while, and then I enrolled at Cleveland State University and with a full-time load, and tried to juggle a couple jobs and a full-time load, and it was it was pretty wild for a while.
Well, it impresses the heck out of me, I tell you. And I can't see any of the of your opposition on the Republican side claiming anything like that. Here's my second question. In our local entertainment paper, they have a article about you called, the paper's called Buzz, and it says, you think you've proved that you can represent a broad range of constituents by the way your district is diverse. And I was wondering, can you describe how your district is diverse and what is your approach to handling that kind of situation? I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, I represent Ohio's 10th Congressional District. I was elected to Congress and defeated a Republican incumbent who held the seat for two terms, and in both of those terms took somewhere about 64-65% of the vote. When I was elected in 96, I won with 46% of the vote. 2 years later, I think I took it up to 60s, and in the previous in the next two elections, I had 74% of the vote. The district I have includes some of the poorest areas in inner city. Includes people who are living on the streets. Includes people who are living in homes that probably are worth $20,000-$30,000. And on the other hand, it includes homes that are worth millions. And so it has some of the poorest and some of the wealthiest people in northern Ohio. And it is somewhat ethnically diverse. It has a large Hispanic population and a small African-American population, a great number of people from throughout the Middle East, and people from all over Eastern Europe. And it has a large number of auto workers who have been desperate to hold on to their jobs, steel workers, some of whom have lost their jobs. It is a district of a lot of blue-collar people who are concerned about trade. White-collar people are concerned about outsourcing. And what I've done is put together a constituency, not based on ideology, but based on taking a stand and based on service. I mean, we have a strong constituent service in my district, which I'm very proud of. And we take care of people, and we help on local issues. When people need help, I'm there. If they need help in keeping trains out of a residential area, I'm there. If they need help in saving a steel mill, I'm there. Help in saving hospitals, I'm there. Help in saving libraries, I'm there. You know, whatever it is, we deliver on constituent service. That's how I built a base. It's really about service in the end. And so I put together a very strong constituency that way. In the last election, I ran for both president and Congress simultaneously. Well, I picked up a couple delegates in my district. I also got 86% of the vote in the Democratic primary.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. I did want to ask you to talk a little bit about the economy and how what your view is of the way to solve the situation. We seem to have maybe the beginnings of an economic recovery, but as many people are pointing out, very few jobs being created as a result of that. And you just mentioned the industrial regions in northern Ohio and the steel industry and the white collar jobs that are increasingly being outsourced outside the country. What would your approach be to these things?
If you count Ohio and Illinois together in the same group, we've lost our two states together about 500,000 jobs in the last few years under this administration. Mm-hmm. Ohio, nationally, we've lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs in America since the year since July of the year 2000, and this jobless recovery is not a recovery at all. I mean, who's recovering? Maybe some corporations are recovering their profits by laying off more people, but there's a wage stagnation. People are not making more. The cost of living is going up, and people end up making less. We have people who are struggling to be able to hold on to their jobs in the face of NAFTA and the WTO, and our manufacturing economy is in trouble. Our steel, automotive, aerospace, shipping, textiles all have seen a downturn. Even some of our agricultural exports are in trouble. We have an economy that is in real trouble, and this administration, what are they doing? They're giving tax cuts to the wealthy. They're spending $200 billion for this war in Iraq, $421 billion for the Department of Defense. The budget deficit's going over $500 billion. The trade deficit's over $550 billion. You know, the country's in trouble, and the priorities are all wrong. We need job creation. We need a public works program. We need a new WPA that can put people back to work rebuilding America's bridges, water systems, sewer systems, and new energy systems, libraries, universities, colleges, rebuild America's infrastructure. We need to have new jobs in energy creation through creating new technologies in solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, and green hydrogen. We need to save our manufacturing base. We consume things here. We should make them again. But we can't do that until we get out of NAFTA and the WTO, because that frustrates any ability to be able to keep jobs in this country. So, you know, these are, and we have to go back and restart our commitment to high tech. But we can't do that because those jobs are just on a one-way expressway out of the country because of the WTO. So we have to get out of NAFTA and the WTO, have principles of workers' rights, human rights, and the environment in our trade agreements, lift up the cause of people worldwide in trade, and also secure jobs in this country by having a strategy for protecting our strategic industrial base.
Our lines are all full, so let's go on and talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a question on foreign policy. If you could discuss a little bit about your views on our most recent involvement in Haiti. And also with that, I understand another congressperson, Representative Waters, is flying Aristide back to Jamaica today, and I was wanting to know if you could also discuss what special powers a congressman might have to make something like that happen.
Well, first of all, the policy in Haiti has been one of malign neglect. This government knew that President Aristide was in trouble. Aristide was seeking about $500 million in loans for Haiti. The United States did not offer any help when Haiti needed humanitarian aid. The U.S. Withheld it. There was a sense that if this country looked the other way, maybe Aristide government would become destabilized, which it did, and of course he was deposed and had to flee the country. Think about this, though. Aristide was trying to get certain corporations to start paying their taxes. The ships that were coming in to the ports were basically avoiding paying their fair share. And so he collided with powerful economic interests. And as a result, I think, you know, one of the reasons why the United States government was not helping him. So we now have a condition where Mr. Aristide is on his way to Jamaica. I think the chapter isn't closed on what's going to happen in Haiti. People in Haiti have a right to democratic governance. They have a right to a rule of law that has been destabilized, and we, you know, the United Nations community now has to help support a return to a rule of law in Haiti.
So, I mean, anyone could have chartered the jet and picked him up out of Africa and flown him home, or?
Well, I don't know that she chartered the jet. I think, you know, Maxine Waters has been very involved in issues relating to Haiti, as have other members of the Congressional Black Caucus, and I share the concerns that they have about the treatment which Haiti is given. And that the fact that she's going to Jamaica, and I wasn't aware of this, take your word, with Aristide is a measure of her commitment. But, you know, we don't, as members of Congress, we don't have special access to requisition military jets. That's not done through Congress.
Yeah, I don't think it was a military jet, but I mean...
Or even a private jet. I mean, you know, she'd have to pay for it.
Yeah, well, it gets back to the punditocracy. I mean, nobody's reporting this story yet, which is...
Well, I think we lost the caller there.
But thanks for calling. And, you know, and again, Haiti is an example of the U.S. government's policies that have not really supported someone who's trying to stabilize a country economically. And my guess is it has to do with interest groups who are benefiting from being able to take a free ride on the people of Haiti.
We have, again, our lines are all full, and we have just about maybe 12 minutes left in this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with Dennis Kucinich. He is in the Democratic primary for president. The Illinois primary is tomorrow, and we're talking about a wide range of issues. And we'll go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number 3. Good morning. Yes, hello. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, somebody in Urbana, line number 3. Do I have that right?
Line number 3?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in Champaign County.
Okay.
I was going to ask about Haiti, and I think malign neglect is not quite stating it accurately. I think there's been a little bit. Noriega's office in the Secretary of, in the State Department has been more than just neglecting. They've been actually then National Endowment for Democracy is acting as a we're doing things at the CIA.
Well, you know, I've raised the issue about that NED in Venezuela, and we're looking at what involvement, you know, they have had in other places.
Excellent. But since that's been covered a little bit, maybe I'll go back to the other thing I was going to ask about, and which is nuclear power. In our district here, we have a nuclear plant, and Exelon has bought it, and they're looking at buying or building another plant, and they got $23 million in assistance from, I guess, the Energy Department, maybe the Commerce Department, to fill out the farms, basically, to do the construction permit. And I just think that is just absolutely an outrage, and I'd like for you to comment on that.
Well, we ought to be, you know, at the exact moment that we ought to be moving away from nuclear power, this administration wants to move further into it. I mean, let's look at what's happened. When nuclear power was first developed in this country 50 years ago, people were told that it was going to create power too cheap to meter. Instead, it's ended up creating power too expensive to use. If there's one thing that's been responsible for driving increases in utility rates in many regions of the country, particularly in Northeast Ohio, where I'm from, it's been the rising cost of nuclear power and the fact that so many nuclear power plants, or a few of them at least, have been neither used nor useful, and that the construction costs have gone way out of control. And more than all that, you know what? No one has ever been able to deal with, you know, the byproducts of nuclear power production, which is the nuclear waste. You can't dispose of it. That's a misnomer. You end up storing it for, you know, for eternity. And that's a hidden cost to taxpayers and to ratepayers. You know, this is unconscionable that we're still permitting new nuclear power plants to be built. We ought to be moving towards solar and wind and all of these sustainable forms of energy. Nuclear just keeps that whole nuclear marching band and chowder society going, and all of the attendant ills and evils it brings to society.
We let's go on next. We have several callers, and we're going to run out of time pretty quick here. So next up, a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah. You didn't touch but the FCC in terms of this consolidation and stuff and the mergers in the mass media. I have a major concern, so I'll give you a chance to comment on that.
Well, and you should be concerned. The public often forgets that the airwaves belong to us. Just as we give utilities the right of utility franchise in order to operate in the public interest, so too when the Federal Communications Act of 1934 was passed. It mandated that electronic broadcast licensees serve in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. That's the measure of the public interest with respect to the broadcast media. As media monopolies have grown, the public interest has been shredded. The public convenience and necessity has been denied. And so the growth of monopolies in media and the concentration of power in media, the vertical and horizontal integration of media interest, has led to the media becoming just another corporate business instead of a platform by which we exercise First Amendment rights. And so while A.J. Liebelein once said freedom of the press belongs to the person who owns one, when you come to the broadcast media, you have a special obligation in our society, and the public interest is not being regarded. The FCC ought to be reclaimed for the purpose of making sure that there's more competition in the media, that there is a that the fairness doctrine is brought back to provide for equality of opinions or for response and a diversity of opinion, and that there needs to be free time provided to all federal candidates by electronic media licensees, so that there is a way of diminishing the quest for campaign dollars, which has to do chiefly about getting on electronic media.
Well, I agree with you 100%.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. We have just about maybe 6 or 7 minutes left with our guest, Dennis Kucinich, in the primary for the Democratic nominee for president, and a couple callers waiting. And we'll go next to someone in Charleston on line number 4. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Couple things. Representative Kucinich, first off, what you were saying about people about, you know, fooling your hearts and minds and stuff like that, I agree with you totally. I mean, 4 years ago, I wrote for Ralph Nader, and I got ripped by a bunch of people. And I even got ripped by my mom because I did that. And my brother looked up and, you know, my mom said, "You threw away your vote." And my brother looked at her and said, "No, the only way you throw away your vote is by not voting."
Well, let's say that, you know, in the year 2000, there were many reasons why Al Gore wasn't elected president of the United States. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one. I ran Al Gore's campaign in northern Ohio in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. He was down, his polls said, by 12 to 14 points 6 weeks out in Ohio. So they pulled the resources out of Ohio. We kept campaigning anyway, even without the resources, and brought his campaign to within 3 points in Ohio. Mm-hmm. With a major effort, he could have won Ohio, and then he would have won the presidency.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a thousand different ways that Gore lost that election, and to try to pin the whole thing on Ralph Nader, I think, is false.
I agree totally.
And so the question here is, what do we stand for as Democrats, and how do we attract people in 2004 to the Democratic banner? If the party stands for peace, we can do that. If we stand for fair trade, we can do that. If we stand for universal health care, we can do that. If we stand for protecting Social Security, we can do that. If we stand for sustainable energy, we can do that. If we stand for corporate accountability, we can do that. I mean, there are things that Democrats can do that can get people excited to go out and vote Democrat. And that could have happened in 2000, and it can happen again in 2004. Now we have time. We have plenty of time to plan. But my candidacy is one way of giving Democrats in Illinois an opportunity to say, look, let's listen to what he has to say, to tell the Democratic Party nationally, start paying attention and start taking a new direction. And then we can actually be responsible for helping to create the change that we want to see happen. And I'm very grateful to have everyone participate. And take, you know, we've taken a few calls here, and it's good to hear all the listeners participating because, you know, tomorrow we need to participate. I mean, this is a good turnout in this election. People really come out and vote to send the party in a new direction. It could have a big impact nationally. There's 17 elections left. You know, we're two-thirds of the way through this process, and there's 17 elections left. So, you know, there's still a chance to have an impact.
Apologies for the last call, but we're growing short on time, and I want to try to include as many callers as possible. We'll go next to someone in East Moline on line number 2. Good morning.
Yes, just want to say to you that I knew you were all right when you garnered Studs Terkel's approval.
Studs and is a great guy.
I'd like to comment about some of the changes in the tax structure. I think in view of what you've observed correctly about the economy, it's unconscionable that the estate tax is being eliminated. I wonder how you feel about the Primal Scream incident in terms of the media and how that affected the Dean campaign. And also, it's my impression that the media, they're real, real comfortable now that they've got two candidates where there's essentially very little difference as far as the Democratic frontrunner and Bush. And I'll hang up.
Well, first of all, with respect to taxes, you know, the estate tax is the one tax that assures that we don't have a condition of inherited wealth creating an aristocracy, and yet you know, the attempt to knock out any taxes on estates, particularly the large estates, has created a situation of permanent inequities in our society. There is an obligation to keep that estate tax in, and I'm strongly supportive of having that a tax kept in place, which reflects a responsibility on those who have great wealth to contribute to the society when the wealth changes hands through a death in the family. Of course, we also recognize that small businesses in particular ought not be penalized. But what happened is that the wealthy interests dragged small business interest into that debate and got people believing that that small business ought to be in league with the wealthiest estate owners, which they really are not. Now the question of the media coverage and of the Dean campaign and that incident after the one primary. I mean, there's no question that it was played over hundreds of times and it had a devastating impact on the campaign. And I suppose that was was an intention to do so. We live in a situation where, you know, the media likes to lift people up and they like to do the opposite. And so, Governor Dean had, what I saw was the most devastating
treatment by the media in those, you know, in playing that over and over and over again. And it really, you know, I think it was a deliberate attempt to try to change the nature of the debate. And while he's no longer in the race, people who do care about these issues will have someone to vote for in the Illinois primary. I'm in this race all the way to the convention.
We have one caller left. Let's include them before we run out of time. Someone on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I live in the Chicago area. Dennis, I've been following your campaign a little bit. I think it's wonderful. I work for a labor union, and I talk to a lot of workers all over the country. I've been watching the administration's record on workers in our country, most particularly federal employees, and the devastating impact that this president's administration has had on them through, for example, the Aviation and Transportation Security Act, where the administrator of the new TSA has been given unfettered discretion on how to treat those workers, and they don't have the right to organize and join a union and bargain collectively. And now in the Department of Homeland Security and even in the Department of Defense, after winning what they call a very short and successful war in Iraq, although I don't necessarily agree with that statement, these employees now are being denied the right to collective bargaining in the interests supposedly of national security. I realize that no one person can turn back the clock on these issues. But I just wanted to say, and I'm sure you would agree, Dennis, that those folks that ran into those buildings on 9/11, they were union members, and they didn't need to check with their steward or their local union president or their contract before they ran in there to die to save those victims.
Right.
What would you do, even if you aren't successful in getting the nomination, what would you do to help these workers?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, as a president, what my view would be. I'd sign an executive order that would remove any barriers to any of the federal workforce being organized. There's just no question that the right to organize and the right to collective bargaining are fundamental rights in a democratic society, and they ought not be denied government workers. And the attempt to privatize government functions through these A95 reviews is another case in point, where there's an attempt to outsource government work as a way of wiping out existing unions. You know, people have in a democratic society an inherent right here to organize, and it ought not be vitiated. And this government has done everything it can to try to defeat workers' rights. And so, whether it's Homeland Security, the Department of Defense, or any of the other important government functions, people should have the right to organize and be able to bargain for their wages. Now, in addition to that, as president, my role would be to see the right to organize vindicated, and that means that we need to wipe out those sections of Taft-Hartley that serve to defeat organizing attempts. So, we really need to go back to what are the democratic principles that ought to be sacrosanct. And I think the right to organize ought to be kept as a pillar of our democracy, and we need to reinstate it. And as a member of Congress, I've fought for that at every turn, and as a presidential candidate, I never hesitate to mention that we're